Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Gravity Podcast listeners, I'm your host, Matt Tebbe, joined by my co-host and co-friend, or co-friending, Ben Sternke.
Yep. Co-friends. I think that's just called being friends, Matt.
I'm going to look it up.
The kids these days just say, that's just being friends. You're just friends.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we quite all know what the friends, what the kids are saying these days.
We don't. I think I reached it's maybe a few years ago, mid-40s, I think, for me, when I stopped trying, you know, slash caring, and just being like, I'm just too old to understand.
Here we go.
What's happening?
Here we go, Ben. Pop quiz. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah.
I'm gonna give you a Gen Z lingo.
Okay.
And you're gonna tell me what it means.
Mm-hmm. I'll just say the first thing that comes into my head.
All right, ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Lit.
I know that one. That one's like cool or like happening.
Yeah.
It's like rad
or dope
thing. Yeah.
All right. We gotta go fast. This is a lightning round, okay?
Okay, lightning round.
Low key.
Low key, like somewhat.
Yeah, like, yeah, good. Yeah, okay. High key.
Maximal. I don't know.
Yeah, it means like seriously or something.
Yeah, yeah, no? Okay.
Facts.
Like I'm just telling you the truth here.
Yeah, it's like we used to say word, you know?
Word.
Did you ever say word? Yeah. Yeah. All word. Right. Mood.
Is that which you announce what mood you're in?
No,
and then you just say it.
If I were to say, hey, the Super Bowl was really great last night, and you were to say mood, it means like, I feel you.
I resonate with what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Mood.
I got it. Let's see. Sus.
Suspicious. I knew this one.
Okay. All right. If somebody says, I thought the Chiefs would win the Super Bowl on God.
On God?
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard that, but I would, context clues, I'm assuming it means like, I swear on God, you know, like I made a very serious vow.
Yes.
I'm talking very seriously to you right now.
Good. All right. Just a few more. If I say that's based, what do I mean?
I feel like that is like, the only way I've heard that is in conjunction with racism. So I feel like I've seen racists online say that things are based. So I think it means cool, but I've never heard it in a non-racist context.
Yeah, based, I think with the way the kids use it, means like legit.
Okay.
But then I think based was co-opted by Nazis and they use it to like signal to other people. Anyway, one last one. Let's see. One last one. Cap.
This is one that I've seen that I don't understand. I don't understand the question and I don't care to. I'm trying to quote Lucille Bluth from Arrested Development. I can't remember what that quote is. But anyway, I don't know what that one means. No. Cap. Like I don't even have a guess. I don't even know what that means. Because I've heard people say no cap, and I don't know what that means either.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cap
no
cap
or no so cap. Cap means bogus or lie.
Okay.
And so no cap would mean like no lie.
I'm not lying. I'm not lying to you here.
Yeah.
I'm speaking seriously. I feel like there's a lot of these, at least the ones that you read to me today, Matt. There's a lot of these that are trying to convey to the listener that I'm being very serious in my speech right now.
I don't know if they are.
No cap, mood. Well, I guess not mood, but like a word. What was the one you said, the word? On God?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On God.
I don't know.
Well, maybe you needed that, listener, and maybe you didn't. Maybe somebody you love needs this.
Yeah.
If you ever meet a Gen Z person, though, this could come in handy. Because sometimes when they're talking... So anyway, the reason I'm thinking about this is I was at a... I went to two parties over last weekend. It was Super Bowl weekend last weekend. So I was at a Super Bowl party from 5... And it went to overtime last night, Ben. So it's 11:30 last night.
That's when I shut the game off.
Eastern like, time.
I'm too old for this. I'm going to
yes. bed. But then the night before, I went to a euchre tournament. Now, euchre is a peculiar card game that's played in some Midwest states.
Yeah. By millennials. No.
No, by boomers and the silent generation.
By Gen Z. Okay.
Anyway, so euchre is just a card game with a partner. And basically, we were at this euchre tournament from 8 p.m. to 1:30 in the morning.
What?
Saturday
That's
night.
That's crazy.
Yeah, or Sunday morning. Yeah, so 8 to 1:30 Saturday night. Wow. And then last night, 5 to 11:30. I'm tired.
Yeah.
And I, two nights in a row, like grazed on an appetizer table for hours on end.
Right.
So I'm fasting. I'm going to start fasting.
you're starting your Lenten fast.
I may just fast all Lent. Yeah. It was crazy. But one of the things that was funny is my son and my wife came with me to the euchre tournament. It was put on by, my son has played on a soccer team, travel soccer team. It was put on by one of the parents of another player. And so that player and my son are friends. So we were there. And the mom who put on this euchre tournament, so my son and this guy are both freshmen in high school.
Yeah, yeah.
So she told every adult there, when you're playing with my son, only speak in Gen Z lingo and use it wrong. So this 15-year-old, oh my gosh, she trolled him so hard. This 15-year-old all night had to listen to 40 and 50-somethings say to him, man, this hand is dripping.
See, we didn't go over that one. I don't know what that means.
Drip is like fit. So when you see, when somebody says nice drip, it means nice outfit. Nice drip is outfit.
Yeah.
Fit is also outfit, right? So your clothes.
Short for
drip
fit.
And fit. Yeah, yeah, but outfit. They were using drip to describe something that was, they were using it like as a synonym for cool.
As a synonym for cool, right.
So they were misusing Gen Z lingo for 5.5 hours at this kid.
Oh, man.
And he, I just saw him over the time just slowly get worn out. You know, these adults got a little more alcoholically lubricated, and he just got worn down all night.
He's like, Mom.
No, around 1 a.m., I said, are you doing okay? His name, we call him Q. I said, Q, are you doing all right? He said, yeah. I said, does your mom always troll you like this? And he looked me dead in the eyes, and he said, yes.
Yes.
That's all he said.
Help me.
Oh, gosh.
That's really good.
Well, anyway, Lent is coming up. Today's Fat Tuesday.
Yes, the day this releases is Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras, as they call it, if you're French. But yeah, the day before, and then Ash Wednesday this year is February 14th. Doesn't happen that way every year, but that's the way it happens this year.
Yeah.
This is interesting because, you know, I find it interesting as a pastor of a church, to talk about Lent because people have such wildly different experiences and feelings about Lent.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot of people who, grew up with it, and just don't have a good feeling about it at all. You know, they've got even maybe like traumatic sort of self-hatred kind of feeling. You know what I mean? Like
remember what I called it yesterday? Post-reactionary Lent hangover.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Where people are, they associate it with, you know, maybe they were encouraged, maybe there's like self-loathing associated with it. And so they're just like, I don't want any part of that. I don't know why people are excited about this. And then there's other people who did not grow up with it. Which is my experience, and maybe grew up in a faith tradition that was a little bit more happy clappy, spiritual bypassing, you know, happened a lot in the charismatic world that I grew up in, where everything was, yes, we're always blessed and, you know, like we're too blessed to be stressed. And so for me and for others like me, Lent, became almost a refuge to be like, oh, I can look at dark things and face the unwanted and undesirable parts of myself in the love of God. Mm-hmm. I don't have to deny them in order to feel like God loves me. I can face them and And yes. I can enter into a space where things are stripped away. And we can, you know, we can enter into the wilderness together. So anyway, I find it a challenge sometimes to lead and pastor in that kind of an environment. And I imagine our listeners are probably similar, various experiences of mm-hmm. Lent are probably present. So, I guess before we get into today's episode, I would just want to say, listener, if you are thinking about maybe participating in Lent or you're not sure how you feel about it, mm-hmm. Well, I'll put a link to this in the show notes, but we have an article on our website called How to Fast for Lent. And it's kind of a really, fasting is one of the traditional disciplines of Lent, along with prayer and almsgiving. And we get that from Matthew 6, you know, when Jesus talks about works of righteousness and, you know, not to do them to be seen by other people, but encourages us to do them. And so those are the disciplines of Lent. And fasting is one of the, I think fasting is probably the most countercultural of the disciplines. Like it's the one that people know very little about. We think about as like, is that self-loathing? You know, is that associated with eating disorders? You know, like,
And there's
dieting?
Also this, plus this moral performance element to it, right? So I'm fasting, so I'm really serious. So I'm
really serious about
trying hard and I'm working really hard. And I think people have not only maybe an allergy to that from a, you know, sort of an old timey gospel, you're saved from works righteousness, but also because a lot of our listeners have tried really hard for a long time to do Christianity right and have failed.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it feels like, oh, here's another opportunity for me to sign up to please God and fail.
or even please myself. Like, could I just make it through one commitment to fast? Could I do this? You know?
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of grief and also pressure and guilt about it.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. So in your consideration of this, I would definitely want you to pay attention to that. And for some people, they find it actually very helpful because they're not in a place where they're ready to, you know, go through the, because it's a lot of hard work to disentangle all the assumptions that we bring to Lent. And so, I mean, I did this a few years ago, Matt. Yeah. I did nothing for Lent. I fasted nothing. I had no special discipline that I entered into.
Ben, might I suggest it's more appropriate to say you fasted from fasting?
Right. I didn't want to be too cute, but
that's never stopped me. So go ahead. So, you know,
I fasted from fasting anyway. So I did that a few years ago because I felt like it was a way of taking care of myself. And that's ultimately what we're trying to do in Lent is this article talks a bit more about it, but it's not a way to perform for God or suffer for God or earn God's approval or get God's attention or anything like that. It's essentially a way of making space to encounter God in a deeper way. And so anyway, if that strikes you as interesting, I would encourage you to check out the article. Again, we'll put a link in the show notes and hopefully it can help you to have a good Lent.
If you at all are on the fence, right? If you're all on the fence, I would say, just listener, that this article, I think, is the most downloaded article on our website.
It is. Right around Lent every year, there's a spike in our web traffic. I don't know how the internet works in particular, but apparently Google thinks that we have some good information about Lent.
That could be it.
Yeah. It's kind of a resource article. It's one of those where we put some teaching in there and we try to give you some good handlebars for what it would, you know, what do we actually mean when we talk about fasting for Lent and what would be a good place to start.
Yeah.
Again, for most people, there may be very good reasons for you not to fast during Lent. And so don't hear it as pressure or anything like that, but an encouragement to think about it, pray about it, discern it with others.
Sweet.
Yep. All right. Well, let's talk about our interview today. Matt, you were not on this one.
No.
With Terry Wildman. I am just realizing that I forgot to load up Well, there it is.
But I have the book, man. First Nations version, an First indigenous Nations translation version of the New Testament.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we talked with Terry Wildman. This was one that I had hoped we could do during our series on the Bible. And so we didn't get to do it in, it can like, that can just be an ongoing theme on the podcast. Every once in a while, we're going to talk to people about the Bible. So we've got an interview with Pete Enns coming up, and this one, was a similar, topic because the First Nations version, this indigenous translation of the New Testament, is a really fascinating project from Terry Wildman, who's actually, I've known him. He and I used to go to church together like 20 years ago, oddly enough. And then I saw him, you know, in the IVP announcements that he had done this translation. So he translated the New Testament into basically an indigenous way of speaking. That is, you know, it goes across tribes and things like that. And he talks more about it, but it is a fascinating translation that has been helpful for a lot of First Nations people who, you know, Christianity has left a very bad taste in their mouth for a lot of good reasons. And it has helped them to re-engage with Christian faith and the scriptures in a way that feels closer to the way that they think about the world. But it's also been really helpful for a lot of white people who have found it, just a fascinating way of helping us look at the scriptures through a new lens. And I think for me, one of the ways that it helped me, and Terry's received a lot of this feedback from other people who come, you know, white people, basically, that it has helped them to sort of decenter some of their traditional ways of thinking and reading the scriptures that are very white, but we don't recognize that. We think of them as just normal. And it's been it's a translation that helps get you outside of that sort of normative, hegemonic, interpretive tradition, to use some fairly big words there.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so it was a great interview. He was a lot of fun to talk to. And yeah. I'm eager to share this with our listeners. I know you weren't on that, Matt, but anything else to share?
No, I've enjoyed reading it.
Yeah.
Helps me, you know, one of the gifts that honoring other kind of worldviews and perspectives as they approach Jesus is that you come into contact with all of the cultural assumptions you have about scriptures and Jesus that you didn't know you had.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, the best assumptions are invisible.
Right. That's how they work.
That's how they work.
Yeah.
And reading something like this translation helps confront us with our assumptions. And then we actually have some kind of dominion or agency over those assumptions now.
Yeah.
Because they've been excavated or brought into our perception. And now we can navigate them. Is this helpful? Yeah. Is this faithful?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Does this lead to justice and righteousness? Does this lead to, you know, injustice and foolishness? So,
yeah.
Let's hear Terry talk about it.
Yep. Let's get into it. Here we go. Welcome, everybody, to the Gravity Podcast. We are talking with Terry Wildman today. Terry Wildman is of Ojibwe and Yaqui ancestry and is the lead translator, general editor, and project manager of the First Nations Version, an indigenous translation of the New Testament, which we are going to talk about today. He serves as the director of spiritual growth and leadership development for Native InterVarsity. He's also the founder of Rain Ministries and has previously served as a pastor and a worship leader. And he and I used to go to church together. Funny story we'll get into maybe about 20 years ago or so. He and his wife, Darlene, live in Arizona. Terry, welcome to the Gravity Podcast.
Hey, Ben. Thank you for having me here. And I'd like to do an introduction myself.
Yeah. Please tell us a bit more about yourself.
Yeah. Well, I'll open up with a few words in Ojibwe. Buju Niji Bimarazig. So what that means is, hello, my friends who share this life together. Terry Wildman, Nishnikaz. That's what my name is. My name is Terry Wildman. Hello, my friends who share this life together with me. I was born and raised in Michigan. My ancestry includes Ojibwe from Ontario, Canada, Yaqui from Sonora, Mexico, as well as English, German, and Spaniard. I am married to Darlene Wildman and have 5 children, 8 grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren. My wife and I currently live in Maricopa, Arizona, on the traditional lands of the Tohono O'odham and the people. It feels good to be here today with all the listeners out there. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I didn't realize. Yeah, thank you for that introduction. I didn't realize you had great-grandchildren.
Yeah.
Well, you look like you're 27. I don't understand that.
Listeners, yeah, understand.
Yeah, three great-grandchildren, so.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Lovely. So let's talk a little bit about the First Nations version. It's kind of the book that we're focusing on here on this episode. It's, I think the interesting thing about it for me is that it's not a translation into a specific native language per se, but into the kind of cultural and linguistic thought patterns found in many original tongues spoken here in these lands. And it kind of follows the tradition of native storytellers' oral cultures. So I wonder if you could just give us a sense of what are some of those thought patterns and ways of speaking that differ from our normal English translations?
Yeah. I'll be glad to share that. I will say a couple of things about the First Nation version and the reason it's in English. There was a purpose behind why we did this. So because of boarding schools, government assimilation policies, the colonial approach to, colonial settler approach to from the U.S. government participated in by the churches. So the churches got involved in actually taking our languages away from us. So if you can imagine the translators on the other side, the Wycliffe translators, other Bible translator organizations are working to put our language, to put the Bible into our languages, right? Our heart languages. Right. That's very important that people hear something in their heart language. And so, the deal is that one side of the church is taking away our language. So, do you think they want us to learn to read our language?
Right.
So a lot of people don't put the dots together here.
Yeah.
And so because of that, today, I would say only maybe 2% of our native people can actually read those translations. Plus, many of them are out of date now, and no one has done any new ones out there. There are a few being worked on now. So we didn't want to take away the restoration of our languages. But we felt that since they're not hearing the Bible in our mother tongue, then we need a Bible that can best as possible word things in ways that bring some of that heart language into English. Mm-hmm. Not in a tribally specific way, but in a more tribally general tribal way, kind of like the powwow culture we have, where we have storytellers, where we maintain a lot of different things. There are a lot of books that were written long ago, and these books had brought more of the way our traditional people, our elders, spoke English from the beginning. Mm-hmm. How English came across with more of our heart language feel. And you can find that in Black Elk's writing. You can find that in Chief Joseph's writings. And so the idea was that we wanted to present the scriptures in a way, in sort of a, as much as possible, a storytelling way, because our people love stories. We learn better by stories than we do by explanations and doctrines. I mean, it's one thing to tell the story, of Jesus healing the sick, or you can just do a Bible study on, all these different scriptures about how sickness, what the Bible's talking about with sickness or this or that. Yeah. So the story for us is more powerful. So we brought storytelling elements into it, But also, we took into account that the languages the Bible is translated in English, we have I don't know, over at least 50 right. English Bible translations, but none of them have been done. Many have been done with certain audiences in mind, but none had been done with the native people as the hearers of it. Yeah. And so after a lot of experimenting and living on Hopi and finding out these things, finding a Hopi Bible, and that Bible didn't, I got it out of the box in the storage room at the church when I was pastoring up there. Mm-hmm. And I was excited. I took it to our elders in the church and I said, can we read out of this, on Sunday? And that's when they said, we can't read it.
Yeah.
And I think I found maybe one person who could partially read out of the Hopi Bible if they had another translation, like the NIV in front of them to kind of guide them back and forth on the scriptures. And so that was kind of the beginning of a seed planting idea that we need a Bible that's written in English in a way that relates to our native people. Mm-hmm. So because of colonialism, there are certain words we wanted to avoid, because in our we have this history where Jesus was brought to our people. Okay, but how was he brought? What kind of witness did our native people have of Jesus? Oh, Jesus is basically a colonizer. He's a takeover. He's one who's willing to force his religion on us and deny our everything about our cultures and who we are, and try to assimilate us into this other culture. And so because of that bad witness, we wanted to stay away from certain words and experiences that pass on generationally through boarding schools. For example, and this is going to begin to answer your question. We went through about 185 words Wycliffe Bible translators have 185 words that are the most important words in the New Testament to get right. So we went through those 185 words as a council. We have a translation council from different tribes and stuff. And we looked at, okay, how are we going to say sin? Mm. I mean, what does sin mean?
Right.
Sin means different things to different people. Mm-hmm. And what is the actual Greek word? It means to miss the mark, to fail to live in the way we were created by Creator to live, and so we wanted to get that across in the best way we as we talked with each other and did some research, we saw that Native people think of possibly those who have bad hearts or broken ways. So we translated sin as bad hearts and broken ways, or sometimes one or the other, depending on the context, because not all sin is from a bad heart, so to speak. Right. That's someone who maybe has given themselves over more to the dark ways. But broken ways can mean, man, I missed the mark.
Yeah.
The path was broken. I wandered from the path, whatever it is, the spiritual path of doing what's right and living in the way Creator wants us to live. Mm-hmm. So because if we put the word sin in, immediately a traditional native reading that, walls would go up.
Yeah.
You're a sinner. Walls go up. Because that's what they heard in the boarding schools. Oh, it's a sin to have long hair, so we're going to cut your hair off. Oh, it's a sin to speak your language. Yeah. It's almost a sin to be Native American.
Yeah.
In that sense, that identity that we had that's wrapped up in our language, in our ways of praying, and all these things, that identity was being called sinful.
Yes.
And so that's why we want to avoid that word. We want to try to, in a sense, decolonize the English so Native people can actually read the scriptures as much as possible in their heart language, more like it would be said in their heart language, And along the way, we met elders, we tested ideas, and the elders would tell us, you're saying it in English the way we think it in our language. So we knew we were on track. We knew that it was getting across. The second thing we wanted to do was do the grandfather, the elder who's teaching the children around the fire or around the kitchen table. And so we tested that idea out, and we've had Native young men say when they hear this, especially when they hear it read out loud, they say, well, that sounds like my grandpa when we sat around and he told me the Native stories. One little girl says when her grandma was reading it aloud to her, she goes, Grandma, the Bible sounds like you. You know, so we get these kind of feedbacks, so we know we're on the right track, but we were still kind of nervous about this whole thing. This is not your standard translation. It's a it's more dynamic equivalence kind of translation. There might be elements of paraphrase in it, even though that's kind of a bad word in the translation world, is to use the word paraphrase.
Yeah.
But anyway, another idea is the kingdom of God. Well, the way kingdoms have been presented to us is from a European base, a European style of kingdom. Okay. Now, Jesus turned that all upside down, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. He says the one that wants to rule needs to serve everybody. The one that wants to be first needs to actually really start last or be last. You know, you're not to boss people around like those Romans do, you know, like the Gentiles do. And the Gentiles of that day and that time were the Roman people, primarily Greeks, the Greek and Roman Romans. And the Romans based themselves much on the Greek culture. And so for Kingdom of God, we did some research and we said, oh, let's present the Kingdom of God as Creator's Good Road. Creator's Good Road, because in Native ways, we're walking the good red road. That's the thing that we want. And then there, so the spiritual is horizontal. No, I'm sorry, vertical. And the natural is horizontal. And in the circle of life, which we have, you'll see a medicine wheel or circle of life. You'll see that cross in the middle of it. And you'll see four quadrants with different colors in it. And that is where the two roads intersect, the natural and the spiritual, that's when everything's in harmony and balance. Mm-hmm. And that's what Native people are aiming for. How do we live in harmony with the way Creator made the world? How do we live in harmony with all of our relatives, which means the animals, the plants, the rocks, earth, and all people, you know? And so we wanted to capture that, and saying Creator's Good Road shows it as a way of life, which we all know that the kingdom isn't a push down, take control. It's an invitation into a new kind of life, a new way of looking at the world, a new way of seeing and walking and behaving. So we use Creator's Good Road. I've got a lot of other examples, but that's, and the other thing that was probably the most key and important thing we did, and I think we were the first translation ever to do this, at least we've been told we are, is that we took the meanings of the names of the people and the names of places, and we found the original in the Hebrew and the Greek. We found the meaning of that name, and we gave it basically a Native feel, but we did our best to really research every name and place. And for our Native people, that has meant the most. The feedback we've gotten from Native Americans that have read this is that, you know, when I read the genealogy, you won me over. I cried through the genealogy.
Oh, wow.
That's how we think. We look at our ancestors. We understand the importance of ancestry. We understand that even today, as we live, we're living with our ancestors inside us. Mm-hmm. And they're influencing us in some way, either through DNA or through the teachings that they passed on to us. And in some spiritual, mysterious way, they may have some influence over us in other ways we don't understand. So we call that mysterious ways.
Yeah.
You know? I love that.
That's what we call the Creator. We call him the great mystery, is one of the ways that we speak of the supreme being of God.
It's so good. We'll be right back.
Let's get back to the show.
Terry, I mean, I hear so much thought and heart and research went into this. And I don't want to put words in your mouth. So I'm hearing you saying it was received well and welcomed by the Native communities and churches. Do you have any stories, more stories? Like you shared that little girl saying, it sounds like my grandma. Can you maybe share, just double click, share maybe another story of how it's been helpful for Native Christians?
Yeah. I can't remember the date, but at least maybe a year and a half ago, after it had been released for a while. It was released in August, end of August, August 31st, 2021. Mm-hmm. So maybe a year after that, I got an email one day from a young Native woman who lives in Canada, and she's going to Bible college. She's attending Bible college. She's become a follower of Jesus. And one of her classes requires her to read a book and then reach out to the author and give feedback to the author about your book, about the book he wrote. And she wrote me and said, I would like to do this on the First Nations version. Would that be okay with you? And even though I told her I wasn't the author, that I was the primary translator on it, but you know, as long as she understood that part, and she did, she said, I would like to do that. So, you know, I can't remember how long it was. I got the response back. And I mean, I could read it to you if I would have known ahead of time to bring that up, but I'll tell you basically what she said. She said in the letter, when I first started reading that First Nation version, she goes, I didn't think there was any way that you could connect our native ways and our native spirituality to the Bible or to Jesus. I've been taught that wasn't possible. She says, so I was reading it, she said, suspiciously. She said, but the more I read it, the more it began to speak to my heart. It began to speak to me in ways that other translations haven't spoken to me. I began to see Jesus in a new light and see him in a new way that didn't take away from the way I've already been taught, but it actually added more depth to who he is for me. I began to see him in the context of my native culture. And she says, and another thing that happened was my mom and dad, she says, are not believers in Jesus. They're very traditional people. And when I became a believer, they were very sad. And I said, well, could we get together and talk about it? And we could read the Bible together and discuss it together. And they said, no, we don't want to read that Bible. You know, there's too much bad stuff that's gone on. Well, she took this to her parents, the First Nation version, told her who did it, Native people, a group of Native people, told her how it's touched her life. And she says, can we read this one together? And she says, they are now reading it. We are reading it together as a family.
Come on.
No, I'm not kidding. It's amazing. So good. And we've actually got feedback through, you know, the Amazon reviews on Amazon.com. Yeah. There's been a person on there who said almost the same thing. They're reading it together as a family with traditional people. Yeah. And so, I'll give you another story that happened just recently. We were in Monrovia, California. We had been asked to speak at this place called the, Fellowship for Racial Reconciliation. And they asked me to come. Well, I was already going to be in their area. So they asked me to come and would I speak on the First Nation version, because they're finding it's actually crossing cultures within their own group, which was interesting. But so one of their group members is a Gabrielino Native person, or you can say Tongva in California. It's one of the tribes there. And she had become a believer in Jesus. She got up to greet us and to welcome Darlene and I into that part of the thing. She gave us a gift, and we again gave her a gift, because that's one of the things we do. When we come into a territory, you bring a gift with you. She got up and then she starts telling her own testimony of how she was ready to give up Christianity because of all, none of her people would listen. They get mad at her. And she was really starting to doubt, what's going on here? Is this the right message? And someone gave her a copy of the First Nation version. She's a woman who's in college now, you know? And she told me that, or told the whole group that when she read the First Nation version, it restored her faith. Mm. She says, and now I give it away all the time. And I talk to people about it and I read from it. And there's more openness than the other approach I was using to try to do this. So it's become something our native followers of Jesus are using in to help share this good story. And also, is there time for one more?
Sure. I love the stories.
Okay. So a man in Canada is going to Iraq. I won't name the people there, but there's an indigenous group of people in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And they've been persecuted by the Muslims. They're indigenous. They have their own indigenous language. They're not Muslim. Okay. And he's been working with them for years, and they're bringing Christianity to this group. And so he got a hold of the First Nation version, and he started how they would often read the Bible. The people aren't speaking English. They would have some English speakers that could translate from English, like the NIV, into the indigenous language there. And so he started doing that with the First Nation version, and he said, they just came alive. They said, this makes sense to us much more than the other translation. It speaks in our way of thinking and our way of seeing. And these some of the women from that little group of indigenous people, they do knitting, and they make these beautiful little lambs and octopuses and different things. And they sent clear back here from Iraq. They sent us, Darlene and I, these little things there with their names on them and with a little thank you note. Thank you for the First Nation version, you know? So it's actually touched people in Iraq, India. Translators have been using the First Nation's version in Mexico. We have a translator who actually, she is the trainer. She's training the translators for reaching indigenous cultures in Mexico.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And she read the First Nation version. She wanted to interview me. And she says, she's using the First Nation version to teach the translators how to take into context the colonial takeover and how that's affected how people read the Bible, you know? And so it's happening like that. It's amazing. We're getting, I could share more, but you're getting the idea. One more thing is non-native people have been talking to me. There's been a lot of people in deconstruction. I've had at least four people say, I couldn't read the Bible anymore. But when I found the First Nation version, I could read it. Yeah. I could read it again.
Yeah.
And it's helping me, you know? So it's going beyond just I look at it like this. It's a gift from our native people to the dominant culture.
Yes.
You know, as a blessing. We're not trying to keep it to ourselves or anything, but we want to share it. And if it can help people everywhere, you know, we're just amazed. And we're surprised that all this has happened.
Yeah.
You know, it was enough for me and our group just to say, can we help a few of our native people understand Jesus better?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you about that because how I heard about this translation is through sort of non-native people reading it and finding it to be very meaningful. There's actually somebody who's part of one of our cohorts and has been part of kind of the Gravity Universe for a long time. He is an Episcopal priest who has been reading it devotionally and kind of wrote to his church about, you know, the new way that it allows him to read the scriptures and hear the scriptures in a certain way. And this is one of the things he wrote in this article was was this. He said, this indigenous translation, talking about the First Nations version, it helps others of us, non-native people, recognize the way that a white Eurocentric lens has impacted translations of our sacred texts, which themselves emerged in an ancient Near Eastern context over hundreds of years. And so, you know, I it does seem to me that part of the gift of this translation is that it helps us non-native people maybe have a new lens for how much our reading of scripture has also been colonized, right?
Yes.
You know, like, and how it's not, and how much that sort of white Eurocentric culture was steeped in ideas of colonization. And so when we read, you know, Basileia, the kingdom of God, we have certain thoughts about that, you know, about what that means.
Right.
And just what a gift it is to non-native people. I wonder if you, I don't know, do you have any other reflections on that? What do you think is going on there when non-native people read this and find it to be so helpful and freeing?
Well, one of the things, when I started working on this translation, I have, you know, good Bible software, Logos Bible software. As a matter of fact, it's available on Logos Bible software. Mm-hmm. But as I began to look at maybe, 15 different English translations, I began to see that there was more similarity between them than there was differences. Mm-hmm. And that they always translated certain things exactly the same way. And any psychologist will tell you, in some term, that when you read just the same words over and over again, they start losing their impact on you emotionally. And so to use different words, just that there to, you know, look at the kingdom of God a different way, mm-hmm. to understand sin a little bit differently, to hear, to see a little more, there's a little bit of artistic things in it. I was told by one person who was a King James only person, okay. And he says the only other Bible I read in King James now is the First Nation version. he says you've captured the beauty and poetry of the King James version, and you might have surpassed it. He said. Now that's huge to me to imagine that, you know, I mean, I still love some of the verses from the King James Version just because of the way that it expresses the English and things like that. Yeah. But I'm not sure. I think there's a great hunger inside people that have been white people that have been raised in our culture. There's a certain amount of wondering about Native Americans.
Yeah.
There's a certain amount of like mystery there. What, you know, they've been taught that all their spirituality is bad, you know, it's all demonic and all these different things. And there's a certain amount, and I hate to say this because there's a certain amount, I think, deep-seated in us of white guilt, you know? And I think this begins to present the scriptures from Native people. And I think there's a great surprise in there. That's how people have expressed it to me. And it's given them a new interest in understanding and connecting with Native American people. They're losing some of the fear, the cultural fear and distance there. Yeah. I don't know. That's a really good question. I mean,
It's a phenomenon. I appreciate those reflections. I think for me, I recognize some of that stuff. I think there is, as you say, there is a white guilt that, you know, is just there, you know, because of the sins of our ancestors, right? And we realize how much has been lost, and it's painful, you know, to think about that and to realize that. There's just so many questions I think that follow on from this for me. One question I might have for you related to that is, as we've become more conscious in the past few years about the harms of that have been done to Native people, you know, to Black people, basically, you know, through colonization, slavery, all that kind of thing. But as we've learned about that, I think one of the dangers that's easy for people to fall into is cultural appropriation. So yeah. Sort of taking some of those cultural elements and using them in an inappropriate way, in a harmful way. And so I wonder if you have a perspective as a Native person who's been working in white Christian spaces for a long time. I wonder if you can help us understand the difference between appropriation and appreciation, maybe is one way to say it. Like, as we read the First Nations version, how can we, I don't know if you have thoughts on the difference between those two things, but, you know, one, being able to appreciate some elements of Native culture without appropriating in harmful ways.
Right. You know, this is a question I've been asked before, and one woman asked me, she said, can we read this in our church? Would that be cultural appropriation if we read the First Nation right. version in our church?
Right.
Yeah. And I said, well, our Native people, historically, among our tribes, have always shared aspects of our culture with other tribes. Okay? And when I lived on the Hopi Reservation in northern Arizona for 5 years, I learned a lot about the Hopi people, and I would attend some of their festivals and their gatherings and dances and things like that. And I remember I saw we went to a buffalo dance, mm-hmm. and I thought, buffalo? Did there used to be buffaloes here? Why are Hopis doing a buffalo dance? And I asked an elder, how come you're doing a buffalo dance? I said, did there used to be buffaloes here? And he goes, oh, no. He says, there was a tribe that came from the plains, and they came out here to visit us, and they showed us, they danced their buffalo dance. And they said, you can have it too, if you like it. And so the Hopis still dance a buffalo dance. Now, they do it in honor of the people that came and gave it to them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I don't know, already that may be giving some answers here.
Yeah.
The idea of not taking, but being given.
Yes.
When you take something without permission, and appropriate it to yourself, then it's not a good thing.
Yeah.
I would say that's appropriation. Some of our tribes are even arguing over some of these issues themselves.
Sure.
You know, can this tribe over here do a Sundance? Mm-hmm. You know, and the Lakota or maybe the Dakota people, I don't like the fact that they're doing the Sundance, you know, and things like that. And so that even among our own people, there's some things. But the good things I've seen is that traditionally we didn't argue about things like that until colonialism. Yeah. You know, we didn't colonize each other.
Yes.
And when we came together with gatherings, now if you go to a powwow today, you will see a blend of cultures. Their powwows are intertribal mostly. And even when a powwow is done with a tribe that is all their own people, they will still bring in drum singers from another tribe. They have the southern drum and the northern drum, and then they have all these different dances. And these dances, some are Ojibwe dances, some are Lakota dances, some are these other kinds of dances. And we all come together, and we see this as sharing the beauty of who Creator has made us to be with others. Mm. That's why we like non-Native people to come to powwows, so they can learn about us. They can actually get out in the arena when they're invited. Don't go out there without invitation. But when they say, hey, this is going to be an intertribal dance, you know, everybody's welcome. Regalia, no regalia. And then people are invited to go out there. Well, they're not appropriating the culture.
Right.
And even in Germany has powwows with all German people. But what happened was they asked the Native people to come over and teach them how to do the powwow. Mm-hmm. And so I heard a Lakota person once tell me, oh man, I'm a good powwow dancer, but I went over there and they're getting better than we are. Those Germans are so precise, he says. So, you know, I'm not saying there isn't some controversy involved. I'm just saying, let's look at honoring. Yeah. What's the best honoring way? So the First Nation version is our gift to our Native people. It's our gift to the dominant culture. So you're not appropriating anything by doing that. You're actually honoring us by receiving the gift we're offering.
Mm, that's a lovely way to put it. Thank you.
And now a word from a sponsor.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
And, you know, in a few minutes, I do want to ask you to maybe read, to share the beauty of this translation, and have you read a passage. But before we do that, I'm wondering, I'm guessing that there are people who are listening, and actually me myself too, want to learn more about Native American culture and history. And so do you have recommendations or things specifically to actually stay away from, like books or TV shows, or, you know, maybe school us in what we shouldn't go towards and what we should, you know, engage in and learn from?
You know, I'd have to almost give you a list of books I would recommend. You know, a lot of the missionary books that were written don't always, they present the culture in a negative light.
Yeah.
They've already prejudged everything. Yeah. They've already decided ahead of time that somehow this westernized form of Christianity is superior to anything they have. Mm-hmm. And we have, I believe that Christians in America, not all, but the majority of Christians in America have a superiority complex about this message, about Christianity, about, you know, you know, they said they were bringing us good news, but we couldn't find the good news in what they brought us. Mm-hmm. It turned out for us to be bad news. And so they didn't even take the idea, never entered their mind that we might have some good news for them.
Yes.
We might have some ways of looking at the Creator through different eyes in a way that would enhance their understanding of Christianity and these things. And I think that is still needed today. Maybe the First Nation version is a step in that direction of telling Christians, you know, in the church in America, you can find beauty here. You can find ways of looking at Jesus and at God and the world and creation around you in a new way, in a way that probably is more, would, can I say, is closer to what Jesus taught than what we're actually teaching now?
Yes.
And so what to stay away from? Well, maybe some of the old missionary books that would present in a negative light. I tell people all the time, read books that actually, if the book doesn't acknowledge that there's been a problem, there's been colonialism, there's been this, you know, takeover stuff, and that we've really messed up things, then don't read it. You know, you're on the wrong track. There are authors out there that will give you the honest truth about it. Quit trying to hide it. And there are some non-Native authors that have written good books that have been affirmed by Native. Dee Brown, you know, is a good author. What's the title of the book? Something about my heart at Wounded Knee, you know?
I'm trying to look it up for you here.
Yeah. Dee Brown's book.
Yeah. Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee.
Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. Yeah. Native people have loved that book because Dee Brown did a good job of presenting the truth about these things. And there's been other books along the way. There's, that have been written and affirmed by Native people, but they're also fine Native, you know, first of all, fine Native believers. If you're a Christian and you want to make connection, there's great books out there that you can read. I can recommend authors. You know, you've got Randy Woodley, Richard Twiss, you've got George Tinker. His books are very challenging to the kind of Christianity we've been offering to people and things like that. So and then move over into the non-Christian Native reading. Read Vine Deloria Jr. Read some others, because we need to hear how Christianity is being viewed by others who have had a bad experience through Christianity and actually acknowledge and admit that they're right.
That's wise. You know,
and because if you can't admit to these things, it feels like a cover up, yep. You know, yeah. Or you make excuses along the way. Oh, those weren't really Christians that did that. Well, they said they were, mm-hmm. You know, and they professed to be, you know, and it's not my job to sort out who was Christian and who wasn't, because I realize that Christians can do horrible things in the right situations or the wrong situations. Christians have done terrible things. You know, if you look at the history of Christianity through Europe, oh my gosh, you know, you almost lose your faith. You know, I had a crisis of faith when I studied how Christianity went through Europe and the whole origin of colonialism, and then the doctrine of discovery, all these different things.
Yeah,
it's shocking, and it's really hard for people who are just really enjoying church, enjoying right. their Bible studies, enjoying their pastor's thing, their little suppers together and things like that. And I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying they're kind of living in, I'm sorry, a little bit of a fantasy world.
Yes.
About what Christianity has is really about and what has been done in the name of Christ that has mm-hmm. been so bad that we need to address and then yes. we need to own up to. And when I say we, I've got Native ancestry. I've got European ancestry. And I was formed through evangelical churches, yes. you know. And I'm having to deconstruct some of the ways I've been formed and Native culture and my Native spirituality is helping me do that.
Yes. Yes.
And so what a little bit you see in the First Nation version is a part of my journey of deconstructing. It's part of my journey of looking at Christianity through different eyes and mm-hmm. being formed in a different way in my faith in Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah, Terry, I think that, you know, I remember having a similar crisis. I read Willie James Jennings' book, The Christian Imagination, and you learn about all that, kind of how the doctrine of discovery, all that kind of stuff was legitimized, you know, by the Christians, the white Western Christians. And I think he points this out, but I remember feeling this as I read the book, what a deep tragedy it is that, because the whole world at that time was like, we were discovering that there were people in far-flung places who were very different, right? And so this kind of like blend of cultures was beginning to happen. And what a deep tragedy it is that we didn't come, European, you know, those of us with European ancestry, we didn't come to Africa, to, you know, to North America, to Asia. Like, we didn't come in mutuality, because there would have been so much to learn, and there still is so much to learn, kind of from each other, if we would come together, you know, in that mutual way. And so, yeah, I appreciate the way that this translation of the New Testament is a reflection of your own journey, yeah. And how helpful I think it can be for those of us who want to learn to live a more decolonized faith in general.
Yes.
Well, would you read for us? Would you read a passage? We've been talking about this book, and I think that there is there's power in just sort of reading the pages, reading the words on the page. But I think a big part of the beauty of this translation, I think, is also kind of how it can be spoken out loud in that tradition of the native storytellers. And so I'd love to hear you.
Yeah, well, I'd like to explain one thing as I'm going to read this interesting passage from Philippians.
Okay.
So we use, in the translation, we've used like phrasing from Black Elk. Okay. Black Elk would say, when I send my voice to the Great Spirit, that's prayer. When I send my voice to the Great Spirit. So we use that in the First Nation version. You'll hear it there. So we were trying to capture some of the older ideas that our elders from, over 100 years ago, how they were speaking of prayer or these different things. But we also wanted to capture a little bit of our modern native culture, which is the powwow culture, is a lot of what our inner tribal culture is. And we have sort of a powwow language and a powwow way of looking at things and the dances and stuff. So we have what's called in a powwow a victory dance. And that's to honor we honor the veterans in that victory dance. And we declare that we are being led into victory, and we are honoring those who are sacrificed for that victory, So in Philippians 3, I'm going to use powwow language. You're going to hear headman dancer. Well, the headman dancer in the powwow is they have a headman dancer and a headwoman dancer. And so they lead the way on every dance. And they're the first ones to begin the dance, and everybody else follows behind them as they dance around the circle. So you have this headman dancer that's leading the way. Of course, you have an arena director and you have different things. But in this one, we're going to talk about the victory dance and stuff. And this is where Paul begins in Philippians chapter 3, where Paul is saying, talking about finishing the race and pressing on, right? Yeah. In our standard language, Bible translation. So I'm going to read it to you from this translation. I do not mean to say that I have won the victory or have already arrived at the end of the good road, but I keep dancing the victory dance, staying in step with the chosen one, who is the headman dancer leading the way. In this way, I can fully become what the chosen one, Creator sets free, has made me to be. My sacred family members, I do not represent myself as one who has finished the victory dance. My one aim is to forget what is behind me and to keep moving forward, dancing the victory dance with firm steps to the drumbeat of Creator's heart. I keep my eyes straight ahead while I dance toward the high honor the Great Spirit has called me to through the chosen one, Creator sets free. So that's using a modern powwow language. Yeah. And Native people will understand that real clearly. I was in a group once in YWAM, and there were some non-Native people and Native people there. And I was in the middle of I had just translated this portion, and I shared it with the group. And several of the white people looked and said, that's not the Bible. That's not what Paul's saying. And the Native people say there, I get it now. It really, this means a lot to me. So you can see right there, the audience in this has been Native people. And then once it was explained, some of the other guys who are kind of like minor theologians, kind of started coming around a little, but it took a while for them to even accept that you could bring it out this way.
Yes.
Well, thank you for reading that.
Let's go.
And really thank you good. For being here. I wonder if maybe just in closing, you can kind of, how can people stay in touch with you and your work? And are there new projects that we should keep our eyes out for? Are you working on anything new right now?
Yeah. Well, one of the ways to get in contact with you, you can sign up for our email on our website, firstnationsversion.com. You'll get a newsletter, maybe every other month or so. We don't put a lot out there. And we also, if there's any Facebook users left out there, we have a Facebook page called the First Nation Version Project, and we try to keep people updated. Sometimes we share samples. We're getting to the place where we're going to do that. So that's one way to keep in touch with us: website, Facebook page. We do have an Instagram page, but I'm sorry, I haven't kept up with it. You know,
it's all good. You can only do so much.
I feel that. But another thing. Oh, how to stay in touch. I was going to say something else, but it just slipped my mind.
That's okay.
Those are
if you think of it later, we can put it in the show notes. But
sure,
good. And any new projects? I mean, are you working on now?
Yeah. That was the other
question. Was that it? Okay, right, good.
Yeah, that's it. Well, since we're a year and a half into Psalms and Proverbs.
Oh, translating
this the same way we did the New Testament, except we've added more consultants. We have a Hebrew consultant, Professor L. Daniel Hawk from Ashland Seminary in Ohio. He's been really helpful on that. He's a Hebrew scholar. And we have Amy Allen, who's a consultant. She is working on her PhD in Hebrew poetry. So she's a really good consultant to have there in Psalms and in Proverbs there. And we have half of our old council is still working from the New Testament, still working on this. And we got new people in there. We have elders. We have many different tribes, tribal representations within our translation council. And Psalms and Proverbs should come out early in 2025. Okay. InterVarsity Press is publishing it.
Okay.
If you go to our website, we have a whole page on our website about Psalms and Proverbs, what we're doing. You can see who the council is. You can hear explanations. There's a lot more on our website if you want to go a little deeper into why we do this and how we did this.
Excellent. Well, we'll put a link in the show notes to those things, the Facebook page and the website, and a link to the First Nations version. Terry, it has been lovely to spend some time with you and to see you again after 20 years or whatever, however long it's been for you and I. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for listening. I'm wondering, do we have time for one more thing or should I just?
We certainly do.
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. I would like to share something that I share with a lot of people about, our native culture and about Christianity and stuff.
Okay.
I'm just going to read it to you.
Okay.
To shorten my story. Okay. I once had a picture in my mind of several pottery jars. Some of them had First Nations designs on them, some Celtic, some African, Asian, and many more. I saw a hand pouring water into each pottery jar. It was like Creator was saying to me that He has poured some portions of His gifts of grace into each ethnic group, gifts of grace that can only come to others through each ethnicity and culture and in relationship with them. This picture has remained with me for many years, and I've shared it many times. I always ask this question of the listeners. Is the body of Christ living in Turtle Island, that's North America, willing to drink from the grace Creator has poured into our native people? That's the thought for you to consider out there. I say miigwech, zindawiyeg, that's thank you for listening.
Yes. Well, thank you for being here with us, Terry. And thank you for that final challenging thought. Well, Christy, I don't know how you experienced that, but I man, my thoughts were going, I feel like a mile a minute, trying to ping off various things that I would have loved to, I don't know, that podcast could have been 3 hours long.
Right, right.
Both because Terry's a great storyteller and because I had a lot of questions.
Well, but there's so things, much to learn. There's so much to learn.
Yeah, there really is. One of the things I thought of, though, that I didn't get a chance to mention, I may have talked about this in the podcast before, but, you know, I took a, it was kind of a course, like an online course on racism through the Episcopal Church called Sacred Ground. And one of the exercises they recommended that people do was to, for white people in particular, was to get in touch with their actual ethnic, like, origins. And so, you know, right at the end of the podcast there, where Terry was saying, you know, the picture of the water pitcher and the gifts of grace given to each ethnic group.
Yeah.
I think the realization I had when I went through that course was that white is not an ethnic group. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a culture. It's not, you know, it doesn't have history. Like, white is a racial category that was invented to justify oppression and greed and colonization. We created this category called white, which says basically we're allowed to oppress you because we're white and you're not. And that, you know, obviously is a very fluid category. People got added to that category as time went on. So one of the ways, like, and I found this a helpful way for me to sort of decolonize from my own white identity, not in a way of like separating myself from it. I think that's an unhealthy way of thinking about it. Like,
sure.
I am white, you know what I mean? Like that I am formed in that. But a way of sort of creating a little bit of distance from the category white as this racial oppressive category was to get in touch with my actual ancestors and to ask the question, like, okay, why am I here in these lands, right? As a person with Danish, descent. I'm a person of Danish descent, Norwegian, there's a little German in there. And I found it fascinating to the family group that I know the most about is my Danish ancestors, who apparently came over here in the 1920s because the post-war economy had caused a really severe depression in Denmark. And there was not a lot of jobs to be had, not a lot of money to be made. And so they came over here because they were going to get free land, free, you know, in quotes, right? Which, you know, probably stolen from the Native Americans. So that's a complex part of my story. But they came over here intending to only be here for a few years, make some money farming the land, and then move back. And they moved, I think they were in South Dakota for the most part. But the Depression hit here in the States shortly after they arrived. And so they never made enough money to move back, you know, and they were renting farms and had to move around every 2 to 3 years. I found it so interesting for just to learn about that history of like, these are my people, like, and the reason that I'm here is this specific reason. And maybe some of the heartbreak of not being able to go back, you know, is still present. Like he talked about his ancestors living in his body, you know, through DNA and all that kind of stuff. And there's all kinds of stuff that people are discovering about like epigenetics and things like that, that make me wonder, you know, I feel like I'm learning about myself as I learn about the reason my Danish ancestors, I know a lot less about Norwegian and German ancestors, but the reason my Danish ancestors are here is they needed jobs, they needed money. And the reason I'm still here, you know, is because they didn't make enough money to move back. You know, they sort of had to stay.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Do you practice any Danish heritage cultural things?
Yeah, that's another fascinating part of us that I think I found helpful. And we do, it's a Norwegian thing. So we do both some Danish and some Norwegian stuff. One thing is we make lefse every Christmas, which is like thin potato crepe, kind of a thin potato pancake kind of crepe thing that you make with this certain kind of flour. And there's a stick, little like wooden stick that you use to make it. And you usually put some like butter and brown sugar on it and roll it up and eat it. So we make lefse every year. We, And then, you know, and one of the other things, my mom has started to learn about, like, she went back to Denmark to visit some sites and kind of learn about her ancestors, because she's, that's where the Danish comes from, is from her side. She started learning about Hygge. I don't know if you've heard of Hygge.
What's
Hygge? Hygge is, man, I'm going to get it wrong unless I look it up, but it's kind of this Danish word that refers to a sense of comfort. And so you can set up your room in a way that promotes Hygge, like comfort and well-being, kind of like I see it as like a Danish concept of like everything is in its right place and everything is very good here, you know? And so anyway, so learning some about that. So
that's awesome.
Anyway, those are the things that come to mind.
Man. Well, I'm sad that, Matt wasn't able to join us on this.
Yeah, I'm sure he would have had some fun.
He would have had so many questions. He totally would. Yeah. I was going to encourage him the next time he goes golfing to bring an extra pair of socks, and he's not here. So maybe you can he's just listening pass to this post. On.
Yeah. I'll pass it on to him to bring an extra pair of socks next time he goes golfing. Why is that, Christy?
Oh, just in case he gets a hole in one. But
well done, man.
Come on.
You are Matt's gonna love in, it. Yeah, you're filling in his shoes admirably. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, you know.
Well done.
All right, listeners. It's been fun.
Yeah, it has been. It's been great. So we'll catch you next time. Peace, y'all.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.